On this week's 51%, some calls reporting domestic violence have been different since COVID.
They've been more extreme, the violence more severe.
And there's a program offering online help to women living with a problem drinker.
Our program is really focused on the woman herself and improving her own life, sort of regardless of what the partner does.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Service providers and others were fearing that the COVID-19 pandemic would intensify domestic and sexual violence. In Berkshire County, Massachusetts, one center is an example seen in other parts of the country. The Elizabeth Freeman Center is Berkshire County's 24/7 resource for people experiencing domestic abuse and sexual assault. Executive Director Janice Broderick tells 51%'s Josh Landes the center faces a sharp increase in the number and intensity of assault and abuse cases.
I think we knew when COVID hit that the conditions that we needed to take, or the steps that we needed to take to stop the spread of coronavirus, also result in increased violence and decreased access to help. So we never closed our doors, by the way. We stayed open. In March, we saw a real decrease in calls, which worried us enormously because we knew things were not okay in our community. I mean, the level of violence in Berkshire County is high to begin with, and with these, the closing of workplaces and of schools and the isolation in homes, which are not so safe for many in our community, we knew that this was not good. So we saw a decrease in calls, and then in May, the calls started to really come in. We've seen a dramatic increase, and the calls have been different.
How have the calls been different?
They've been more extreme, the violence more severe, the options for help a little more limited because of coronavirus. I mean, people were afraid to go to the hospital because they didn't want to catch the virus, even if, you know, they had been beaten or raped. People were waiting until really they couldn't take it any longer to reach out for help. And it was harder to reach out for help because when you're isolated, you know, you need some private time to reach out safely. And because of the isolation in the homes and the closing of the courts and overwhelmed police departments, that made reaching out for help more dangerous. We've been seeing more calls coming in from police departments than we've seen in the past, from all around the county. And I think that's because, you know, police are responding to these calls and they're reaching out to us for help. So that's a really good thing.
There's been a lot of discussion about reopening schools in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and for many folks that the center works with, schools are a place of safety or refuge from difficulties at home. As debate rages over the safety of bringing kids back into school buildings, what are your thoughts? You know, how is this dynamic of either more remote learning or these hybrid models going to impact the kids that you work with at the center?
We're going to have to adapt. I mean, it's, you know, the closing of schools affects our work in a number of different ways. And it affects the adults we work with. I think we're going to see a lot more difficulty with parents working, which means more poverty and financial stress, which also are risk factors for increased violence. Our programs that we do with kids in the schools on healthy relationships and sex education, we're assuming we won't be allowed in the schools like we normally are. We usually do programming during the day, during school day, with entire classes. Our youth educator team is working very hard to develop online options and modules so that youth can access that and schools can access that. I mean, we'll have to see what happens. I think, you know, when this hit in March, I don't think any of us anticipated that this would go on for so long. And now there, sometimes I think there's no end in sight.
That was Elizabeth Freeman Center Executive Director Janice Broderick speaking with 51%'s Josh Landes. If you're a woman living with a partner who drinks too much, a researcher at the University at Buffalo may want to be in touch with you. Dr. Robert Richterich is Senior Research Scientist in Clinical Psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences, and he's behind a project called Stop Spinning My Wheels. He spoke with 51%'s Ian Pickus.
Oftentimes when people think of getting treatment for an alcohol problem, they think of the person who has the problem, the drinking problem. But what they don't realize is that the person that's living with the problem drinker has a problem too. It's not the drinking. It is the problems that arise from having a partner, and in this case, women with a husband or boyfriend that they're living with that has a problem. These individuals, women, can experience a great deal of psychological distress as a result of the partner's drinking. The partner is preoccupied with alcohol, spends a lot of time drinking, and that affects the life of their spouse or girlfriend. We oftentimes think of treating the person with a drinking problem, but we don't think about working and helping those who are experiencing stress as a result of living with someone who has a drinking problem. The rates of depression, anxiety, and stress-related disorders, occur at about twice the rate among spouses of alcohol or drug abusing partners than they do among those that don't have an alcohol or drug abusing partner. Healthcare costs are much higher. So this is an important population in its own right. Regardless of whether their partner stops drinking or not, we can help these individuals with the stress that they are experiencing. The project itself is comparing different approaches or different ways of providing that information and coping skills totally online or by phone.
For the purposes of this study, how do you define problem drinking?
Problem drinking is when people complete our screening questionnaires, we have a series of questions that we ask about the partner's drinking. And generally, it is influenced by not just the amount of alcohol that their partner is drinking, but the types and the frequency of problems that the partner's drinking is causing and has caused the partner.
So basically, if it seems like a problem for that household, it probably is.
Yes. I mean, I think that, one good way of, in a simple way of defining whether somebody has a drinking problem or not is whether, regardless, to some extent, regardless of how much they drink, is whether that drinking is interfering with their life and is causing problems, whether that's causing problems in the family, causing problems at work, causing problems, with health. So those are the types of things we assess when the individual is contacting us regarding their partner's drinking. In most cases, most of the partners do meet the criteria for problem drinking. I should note, though, that we are not really working with the partner at all. The woman does not need the permission of the partner to participate, and many of them do not tell their partner they are participating, because our program is really focused on the woman herself and improving her own life, sort of regardless of what the partner does. Although I can say that sometimes when the woman starts changing and making improvements in her life, it could result in some changes in the partner's life and the partner's drinking too.
Now, I imagine someone listening to this may wonder, why is this created for women with male partners? But according to what I've read from the University of Buffalo, in most cases of the millions of people in the U.S. who live with someone with a drinking problem, most of the time that is a man and not a woman, right?
That's correct. There's a larger number of women who are living with an alcoholic male partner than men living with an alcoholic female partner. Now, that's not to minimize the fact that men who live with an alcoholic partner can experience a great deal of stress as well, and could very well need the help as you know too. But for research purposes, we are focusing primarily on women who have an alcoholic husband or boyfriend that they are living with.
So is it possible for those people to improve the situation or their experience of it, assuming that the partner doesn't stop drinking?
Yes. Oftentimes what happens is that the individual gets into a kind of the woman may get into a rut of their whole entire life is focused on getting the partner to stop drinking. And, you know, and they do everything they can to get him to stop drinking or to cut back dramatically. They don't spend much time taking care of themselves and focusing on their own life and how to improve their life, regardless of what the partner is doing. And so that is really the a lot of the focus of our program. You know, and it also where our name comes from. We call it the Stop Spinning My Wheels program, partly in large part because a lot of these individuals, you know, have the experience of feeling like they're spinning their wheels when it comes to trying to get their partner to change. And I guess our goal is to get them to stop spinning their wheels and start focusing on improving their own life. And like I say, sometimes when they start improving their life and changing how they respond to the partner and his drinking, sometimes the partner will start coming around as well and start changing too.
Now, you're looking for 450 women from New York State to participate in this project, and already 200 women have signed up since last year. What are you trying to learn from their experience of this program?
Well, we're comparing three different ways of providing, helpful information to these women. And so we want to know what is the best approach. So some individuals will get a self-paced kind of coping skills training program, which they do on their own over about a 12-week period by logging onto our site and going through a series of sessions. Another group may receive the same thing, but then they may also get phone calls from a coach who's a counselor who can help with any questions the individual has or help them apply the information to their own life. And others would view and read on our site a lot of information that is already available on the web. It just compiled in a way that's more readable and understandable and helpful. So we're comparing those different ways of providing information, and we're hopeful that we can find either which type of approach works best for certain individuals, or overall which type is better.
Does this take into account the pandemic at all? Because I imagine people are spending more time at home. We know stress is elevated during this time with, you know, rising unemployment and just smaller social circles available to people. I have to imagine that some of these issues are being exacerbated by just this massive societal change we're seeing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point and a good question. You know, it can work a number of different ways. And I think only after we've done more research will we really know or hopefully understand it more closely. We do get a sense that we've had more interest and, you know, in our program and our project, primarily in part because one thing, as I mentioned before, is that these individuals, oftentimes to cope with their partner's drinking, they've developed very busy lives. They may have a career or work, and they work a lot, and they or they're heavily involved in childcare. And with the pandemic, they are, you know, a lot of them have started working from home or were working from home, and you know, doing homeschooling or whatever, or assisting with that. And as with everyone in the pandemic, regardless of whether you have a partner with an alcohol problem or not, you know, everyone, it's a time when people have started to kind of reevaluate their lives and to try to, you know, and thinking about how they can improve their lives and what's gone wrong. You know, in the case of somebody with a partner with a drinking problem, they're keeping busy and their career and all of that has been their way of coping. But now they may not, they may have more time on their hands or, you know, there's other stressors involved. And so they don't, they may not have that as much, and they're starting to look at their life and saying, this is something that I need to improve. And they're starting to want to take more care of themselves. In other cases, because of the restrictions, when things were all closed up, their partner actually may have stopped drinking or cut back on their drinking simply because of availability or the lack of availability. But as things have started to open up now, their partner, you know, they may, the individual, may, the woman may have had sort of a false hope that, oh, he's finally doing something. But then as things open up and there's greater availability, the partner might be starting to drink or drink more heavily again. And so the woman now is, you know, is hurt by this and is seeking help.
If someone is interested in getting in touch with you and this study, what should they do?
Well, the best way is to go to our website, which is stopspinningmywheels.org. On there, they can read more about the project and what's involved. I should note that in addition to the program itself, we do have a series of research interviews before they start the program, and then for 12 to 15 months afterwards. People do get paid for their time doing the research interviews, but the program itself, there is no charge for. But they should go to stopspinningmywheels.org. They will be invited to take a self-screen, which is just a questionnaire on the site that will give them an idea whether it looks like the project is right for them. If it is, they can schedule right on the site a time for a phone call with our staff, who will interview them some more and describe the project to them in much more detail. And we'll be able to tell them then for sure whether the project is right for them and can get them started on our research assessments and then participation in the program. There is also an 800 number if somebody would feel more comfortable calling that, and it is 1-800-679-3010.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you'd like to add?
I think that's about everything. I think that what we need to recognize is that this is an important population that's often hidden and underserved. Frequently, they are, they're reluctant to come forward, about their own problems. They fear stigmatization of their partner or potential harm to his or even her own career. They're embarrassed or fear that people think they're mentally ill or crazy or something like that. They fear their partner's reaction if he learns that they're seeking help. And also, sort of like I referred to, they oftentimes have heavy household employment and childcare responsibilities that limit their flexibility in attending sessions, in a clinic or at specific times. And that's why we think the online approach may be the most, may be able to reach the most people. And one reason why we are studying that in more detail. But it is an important population that we tend to forget about and that deserves help themselves.
Again, that's Dr. Robert Richterich, and the project is called Stop Spinning My Wheels. If you're interested in taking part, stopspinningmywheels.org. And he wanted me to add here that it's safe, secure, and anonymous. For 51%, I'm Ian Pickus.
Poet Lisa Marie Brimmer addresses personal and social issues. She is co-editor of Queer Voices, Poetry, Prose, and Pride Anthology from the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Brimmer teaches at Century College. KFAI's Dixie Treichel produced this audio portrait.
My name's Lisa Marie Brimmer. I'm a poet and educator, and I live in the Twin Cities. I live in Minneapolis. I just moved recently, and I just found a notebook of mine from when I was in high school, and I found some poems in there, really bad, beautiful poems. Just all that fresh heartache, that fresh confusion of trying to grow up. I know we're all feeling these effects of social and physical distancing, and we're all feeling the loss of Mr. George Floyd. I have a poem named Heart Medicine. I wanted to just be with our hearts right now. They're going through a lot, even if we're not always aware of it. Everywhere loss exposes my impatient neck. Cinnamon for unrest, even when summer blues lie sweltering, a panting dog, even when God feels good and gone at once, hands that are up, hands that do not promise to shake, hands that do not die, hands that love. I know the sound, the pop of the aster. I know the headline. I sing good morning, heartache. I sit down, patient times. Hands that pull at the garlic mustard leaves, grasping, now is the time for protection spells. I wrote that on May 26th of this year, deeply, profoundly in grief and not yet afraid in the same way that I found myself afraid later that week due to uprising and all of the civil war we've been experiencing. You know, it's not new for us to be experiencing this as queer folks or folks in bodies that are not white ever on this land. And so it's definitely been a time that's called for patience and the need to sit down and just let those emotions happen. But I think there's something about how in Minnesota, we live in such beautiful four-season country. The light in different seasons just is really romantic in a way. Family portrait. It's more of a winter poem from a collaboration that I did with a dear friend of mine, Corey Pong. The winter eats the sirloin off the knife without a blink. The knife is a ritual with other plants, akin winter. This poem has a deep place in my heart because I think as an artist, I feel like such a deep sense of connection to my collaborators. I'm working on a mural project with Tori Hong, Hayden Bui, and my partner Katie Robinson, a series of affirmations and images that are intended for young audiences, and rustle up some sweet music, song, sweet singing. Let the beat drop while we holler and dance about with Jimmy and Lorraine. Allow me to reintroduce a self. You are a friend. You are enough. You help create great stillness in me. I hear people say things like tightening the circle right now. So maybe we're evaluating our friendships and relationships and really feeling on who's really there for us and really cherishing them. I like this poem because it really does cherish queer family, which is so important. With records turning and Amazon time revealing strings of light, purpose. My family is a spur spun tight with air pockets, a plot.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1625.